you're not familiar much with the history of our church, there's one thing that we have kind of been proud of, a label that we wear, although I don't see it on many t-shirts, but that we are a peculiar people. And we're peculiar for many, many reasons. I wish that we were peculiar for what we were supposed to be peculiar for when we said that we were peculiar people. But we've been around for a while now, so we've developed a whole lot more peculiarities, have we not? And one of them is this weekend. We worship on a peculiar day, and we fall in between the weekend events. And we've never quite figured out how to do this. What to do with it. Yesterday was Good Friday. Tomorrow is, okay, you know, or we've referred to it with a word that sometimes, depending on what crowd of Adventists I'm in, I'm not allowed to use. But when we come to worship, we miss them both. And I was, up until Thursday night, ready to move on with the church at Thyatira. And in 38 years, it would not have been the first Sabbath before tomorrow that we call that name that sometimes I'm not allowed to use, that I just politely ignored. Because that's what we kind of do, right? We don't celebrate tomorrow. We didn't celebrate last night. So here we are, right? So usually, like I said, more often than not, I would just continue in my sermon series. Except at the very top, I would say this one thing. On Sabbath, he slept. On Sabbath, he rested. And if there was ever a Son of Man who needed rest, ever in humanity's history, it was Jesus on Good Friday. See, but I'm a product of my early experience, because of the many opposition groups in our church, the one that opposes a more Easter kind of service. There, I said it. I'm sorry, I said it. The ones that oppose that seem to be pretty vigorous in their opposition. I was told once that I couldn't even use the word. I went to preach at a church, and I got in the mail, this was before the internet, and I got in the mail a list of what I couldn't do because I was preaching on this particular Sabbath, the one between Good Friday and the one between that Sunday, that with that word I'm not allowed to use. And they told me why I was not allowed to use it. No reference, absolutely whatsoever. So no Sunday service, certainly. I was in a couple of churches where I thought, why don't we have a Sunday service? You know, just on that day, just on tomorrow, just that. No, absolutely not. I said, okay. Even though these are the same people that would argue with other Sunday keepers that to celebrate Sunday because of the resurrection, you should only do it once a year and you shouldn't do it every Sunday. We won't even allow that once a year on a Sunday. And it made me smile because the hymn that we sung today was by request of our treasurer, who spent many, 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 many years in one of those other churches. And he's been in this church 25 years, and he's never heard that hymn. And he said, I've heard that hymn every Easter we played that hymn. Can we do it? And I said, sure. Why not? Now, you just sung that hymn. I'd never heard it before. Can you tell me why that's not in our hymnal? I can. Because we're in between. He hasn't arose yet. Right? Yet, we have Christ the Lord is risen today in the hymnal. And every time that we sing it, it isn't true. At least if you're observing that weekend. You with me? We either need to sing it the week before, which means Christ the Lord is risen next week. So today I will acknowledge that maybe, if you don't mind, that we would pause in our deep study of the churches of Revelation and talk a little about what happened on this weekend so many years ago. Because if we didn't, we wouldn't even be a church. There'd be no reason to even gather today, Sabbath, Sunday, Friday. It wouldn't matter, would it? But it's been revealed to me. It's been revealed to us why we're here, even though we may be in between the days. Most of the narrative of the cross in the Gospel of John is unique to John only. There's very little found information, at least found, as to what happened yesterday, what happened on Good Friday. I'm not 100% sure why, except to note that I believe the Gospel of John was written so many years later that John has had time to reflect, and he remembers things that maybe back when the other Gospels were written, the disciples were still in shock and hadn't quite figured it out. John has figured it out. He's also become very humble when he speaks of that day, because you have to remember that by the time John begins to write to you about an event that he witnessed, in the past 60 years, he has seen at least 10 of the other disciples be crucified also. That may bring a bit of perspective, a humble perspective on John's account and why his view of the cross, his view of Good Friday is so unique. What we learn from the cross before we get to John 19 is that they tried to convict him of being a false prophet. That was the charge that was brought against him. Didn't mean much to Pilate. They knew they had to change tact in the middle because that didn't mean anything to Pilate. He didn't care whether or not Jesus was a false prophet in a religion he cared nothing about. In fact, he told him, remember, if this is one of your laws that's being broken, then take him to Herod. And in the interim, that taking to Herod and bringing him back to Pilate, they changed tacks, if you will. Then they convinced him that he was claiming to be another king. They convinced him that he was trying to rival Caesar. Now you get Pilate's attention. But they also wanted him to suffer the execution that Rome only reserved for sedition against the emperor, and that was crucifixion. They didn't want him just dead. They wanted him cursed, because the law clearly states anybody who hangs on a tree, anybody who hangs between heaven and earth is cursed by God. So no matter what happens after this weekend, when his followers try to tell us that he's anointed by God, that he was the Messiah, we could say, no, he was cursed by God. And that body hanging in between heaven and earth is proof. They convinced Pilate that he needed crucifixion. It's what they wanted. But he also predicted it, remember? He said this. Go back one. I don't know what's going on with this. There. That's what I was trying to get. He predicted it back in chapter 3. Just as Moses was lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. The serpent and the cross, there's a lot in common. There's a lot. Both are symbols of suffering. Both are called on to be objects of faith. Both free Israel from certain death, frees all from certain death, with the only condition being what? The only condition being faith. God told them to look and they would be saved. We look at the cross and have faith that he's there for us, that he's cursing death for us, just as the serpent did. And we have what? We have faith. Also, both became idols. couple hundred years later, they had to destroy that bronze serpent in the wilderness because they began worshiping it. Today, have we made an idol of the cross? Certainly. I used to have a professor, though, that said he believed that if a whole bunch of people would have gotten on the ark, we'd all be wearing little arcs around our chest. They handed him over to be crucified. So they took Jesus, and carrying the cross by himself, he went out to what is called the place of the skull, which is in Hebrew, Golgotha. They crucified him between two others, on either side of them, with Jesus in between. We've seen it. Probably we haven't seen it depicted as bad as it really was. But the Romans didn't invent crucifixion. The Phoenicians did. But the Phoenicians found out that if you just hung somebody by their arms, they would suffocate in minutes. The Romans perfected it. The Romans found it a way to lengthen the time that it took to die. Because they wanted to make it an instrument of not of execution, but one of shame. One of abject humiliation. They were required to carry their own cross. It was done in public as warning to others. Golgotha was probably on the side of the road, the busiest road heading out of Jerusalem, outside the city wall. Everybody saw it. And it was a warning. This is what happens when you mess with the emperor. Death came in three ways. By suffocation, eventually, by bleeding to death, or by parasitic infestation. Some people took up to a month to die on the cross. Because they would feed them, and they would give them water. Remember, Pilate's shocked that Jesus died after 3 hours. Six, sorry. Breaking the legs to hasten death. Because again, they can't pull themselves up to breathe anymore, so they eventually do. But they also did it, if not for the time, but to also make sure that no one could escape. Because while they respected the Passover laws, that they didn't want the bodies hanging up on the Sabbath, on the Passover, while Rome respected that, as soon as sundown happened, they threw them right back up on the cross. Told that Pilate had an inscription written and put on the cross. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Many of the Jews read this inscription because the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city. Many read it. Do you understand? Many read it. Why? Because it was in a popular place. Because the place where Jesus was crucified was in the city. It was written in Hebrew. It was written in Latin. And it was written in Greek. Chief priests, the Jews said to Pilate, don't write the King of the Jews, but write, this man said I was King of the Jews. And notice what Pilate says. What I've written, I've written. Don't bug me about this anymore. See, because they had him over a barrel politically. They knew that if there was one more riot, that was it. They knew that Pilate was hanging by a thread with this particular emperor. There had been two riots in the past 5 years of his governorship. Two riots that Rome could not abide by anymore. If there was one more riot, that would be it. The leaders knew that. The leaders used that. When they said that he claims to be Caesar, listen, the people are going to riot. As soon as Pilate heard that, that's when he grants the order to crucify him. He knew he had him. But notice this now. Now that he's done their dirty work, what I've written, I've written. You got nothing on me now. It's a blow because the Jewish leaders said it themselves. We have no king but Caesar. But just when you think that Pilate might be in control of this, that Rome might be in control of this, that the church, the believers, might be in control of this. John adds this. When the soldiers crucified Jesus, they took his clothes and divided them into four parts, one for each soldier. They also took his tunic. Now the tunic was seamless, woven in one piece from the top. So they said to one another, "Let us not tear it, but cast lots for it to see who will get it." This was to fulfill what the scripture says. They divided my clothes among themselves, and for my clothing they cast lots. And that is what the soldiers did. Just when you think that there might be some control somewhere else, John reminds you, no, this was a fulfillment of prophecy. It wasn't because Pilate ordered it. It wasn't because the soldiers carried it out. It wasn't because the church of the day, the religious leaders of the day, ordered it. It was because it was a fulfillment of prophecy. No one's in control here but God. Notice John doesn't describe the darkness of the day found in all three of the others. He doesn't include the mockery at the cross. He wants us to make sure that this is all under God's control. John's interest is that we understand that Jesus' death is voluntary and purposeful. You don't hear him say what he says in John in any of the other Gospels. I laid down my life. Nobody takes it from me. He has something to finish, and he knows it. He highlights the fact that soldiers' actions were an amazing, exact fulfillment of prophecy on the part of the people who were in no way aware that they were doing so. It's pretty impressive when people who don't even know the prophecy, don't care about the prophecy, fulfill it for them. This is beyond the shot of any humans who think that they're calling the shots. Meanwhile, standing near the cross of Jesus were his mother, his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. I love taking this little detour, but to talk about this list of women who were at the cross, there are three ways to interpret it, three ways to look at it. One is to list them, to go through the list, and it's not proper, it doesn't make sense, okay? Because just naming them would mean that Mary was Mary of Clopas and Magdalene was the sister. So it isn't natural the way that the list reads. The second way to read it would be that Jesus' mother and her sister, who is Mary, the wife of Clopas. That doesn't make any sense either because that means Mary has a sister named Mary. It's not likely, is it? But the third, I think, is more natural and more likely, and that is there are four women. One was his mother. The other was his mother's sister. Another Mary, who's the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. See, because it's the relationship might be more difficult, and there's a lot of opinions, but when you look at the list the way it is in Mark and Matthew, among them were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. And then Mark says there were also women looking on from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and the younger of Joseph, and Salome. So if you compare those lists, they're saying that one woman was Mary the mother of James and Joseph. Mark says that a woman named Salome was there. Matthew says that John and James' mother was there. So do you see? If Mary's sister was Salome, the mother of James and John, that would make Jesus and John cousins. So that just might explain what happens next. What happens in the next event after he's been crucified. We all know that, right? Another one that is not in the other Gospels. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved, this is the third time John has referred to himself this way. The disciple whom he loved, standing beside her, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her into his own home. It makes sense that James and John were Jesus' cousins. He would give her to someone else in the family. See, I think that Jesus had brothers and sisters, but the chances are that they were probably his stepbrothers and sisters. They were children of Joseph from his first marriage. And we're not sure what happened. And then they say, well, why didn't he give them to James? Well, when we studied through Acts, James isn't going to live the rest of the year. He will be the first apostle to be martyred. He gives her to John. Do you think Jesus knows that? So he does it legally, but then he also does it for two reasons. One is to note his own presence here. John wants you to know that he can give you this information. Why? Because I was there. I was an eyewitness. He's also closest to Jesus. He says, he's referred to him this way before. One of his disciples, the one whom Jesus loved, was reclining close to his heart. That's the way he describes where he was sitting during the Lord's Supper. And as I pointed out, there's a humility that the years have brought to him. John is the one who knows. Why? Because I saw it. I was there. I didn't understand it when I was there. But now I'm nearly or over 100 years old, and I'm getting it, and I want you to know it. The narrative also functions to show the selflessness of the Son of Man at that moment. How easy is it to think of somebody else when you're in pain? Absolutely impossible. The pain he's going through is indescribable. Can't even be described. I used to try to describe it. I don't anymore. The reason being is because Jesus doesn't describe it. That's not what is on his mind right now. Behold your son. Behold your mother. To be able to even say the words causes pain beyond what you can imagine. Yet he's going to make sure that they're taken care of. And by the way, before he utters his last breath, who else is he going to make sure is taken care of? The very ones that are crucifying him. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. So when he says, behold, too, there's something special about that word. Because he says it a couple of other times that kind of go along to this. Okay, like I said, John points out this was testified so that you may also believe. His testimony is true. He knows that he tells the truth so that you may also continue to believe. John again is pointing out, I was there. I want you to know that I was there. Now we can look at, behold, Jesus said to her back at the wedding of Cana, woman, what concern is that to you? My hour is not yet come. It's the only other time that his mother is mentioned. Is there and here. It was the day of preparation for Passover, about noon. He said to the Jews, behold your king. Behold your man. In both situations where he mentions Mary in his gospel, he calls her woman. See, John has this other unique element in it, is that he points out this behold your mother. And when he mentioned before, it harkens back to the last time that he mentioned his mother, and that was the wedding at Cana. The beautiful thing about the wedding at Cana, to me, is that he reserves that event in a tiny little village with this nameless couple, these people who you don't know. All you know is that they were friends of Mary. Gary Vinden has this great idea that when Jesus came back home before he goes on to, before he leaves home, if you will, to start his mission. In other words, he's on his way from Galilee to towards Jerusalem to be baptized by John. And he has this wonderful idea that when he came to say goodbye to his mother, on the way out the door, his mother went, don't forget the wedding. Just a few weeks after his baptism and his temptation in the wilderness, Jesus shows up at that wedding. Because the guest list, it just says his mother was there. His mother was there. Why? She may have even been the hostess. Why is she so concerned that they ran out of wine? I just think it's beautiful. I think it's so human. And then that he picked a wedding to perform his first miracle of a couple that we don't know. And of course, the wine is hearkened to what? What he set the table with, what the table was set with the night before this was to happen. The wine, the abundance, the forgiveness becomes his blood. Remember, there is no communion narrative, if you will, in the Gospel of John. Why? Because the bread and the wine were mentioned in the previous other miracles. John found no reason to tell you about it. It's only the foot washing that's mentioned in the Gospel of John. But when he says, "Woman, what concern is that to me and you? My hour has not yet come." What does he mean? It's this hour. My hour has not yet come. It isn't time to spill. It's this. And the fact that he calls her woman, the fact that it's just so, again, it's so human. He's the Son of Man. He's the King of Kings. But he wants to be personally involved with these human beings at this wedding. This couple that we don't even know. And he wants to make sure that their wedding went off right. He doesn't want to be known as the wedding that ran out of wine. So he grants it for his mother. He grants it for this couple. And then eventually, as she's standing at the cross, all this is brought back to us because we've read through the Gospel of John. We've been through his life. Behold the man. Behold. Jesus uses the word behold then when he says, "Behold your mother. Behold your son. Look. Behold. Look. Hear." When Jesus had received the wine, he said, "What? It is finished." Remember, I told you before that Jesus never even mentions the pain, so I quit talking about it. I used to do an autopsy on him. I used to tell you exactly what he was going through, what it meant to be scourged, what it meant to be crucified, exactly what he was feeling, because any doctor can tell you what he's going through. And I used to do it. And yes, it would cause these faces, and people would come up and they say, "Why'd you go through that?" Because I thought that it meant something. But then it dawned on me over the next 30 years of preaching through this, of teaching through this, his pain is not mentioned at all. What is going on with him physically isn't mentioned at all. Because why? Because first of all, that didn't kill him. Second of all, it doesn't matter to him. He's sold out for you and me. It's not what matters right now. He's shown you what's possible. What's possible for a human being when they are completely selfless. It shows you what we were supposed to be. The only mention of what is going on with him physically is in the Gospel of John, by the way. After this, Jesus knew all was finished. He said, to fulfill Scripture, "I am thirsty." That's it. That is the only thing you will find him ever mentioning his pain. He's thirsty. Guess what? Of course he is. He's bleeding to death. A jar of full sour wine put on a sponge, full of wine on a branch of hyssop, held out to his mouth. He's bleeding. He's in hypovolemic shock. His body is trying to get some volume in him somehow. John also reminds us, too, that there's a physical presence here. There's something really happening to him. This would happen to any human body. We've seen it. People who are bleeding are constantly thirsty. Gave him the wine, and when he received it, he said, "What? It is finished." Then he bowed his head, and he gave up his spirit. It's an interesting Greek word, tetelestai. It's the way it's pronounced. That's why I put it in the bulletin. You may not recognize it, but it's Greek, tetelestai. It's in the perfect tense. It's complete. It's perfect. All action is completely fulfilled and done. We don't have the perfect tense in English. The best we have is the past tense. But the past tense doesn't mean that whatever was happening in the past is completed after it's past. The Greek has the perfect tense, and that's what this is. Perfect. All action, not just in the past, but all action completed. It is finished. His ministry, his life, his execution, his mission, all fulfilled. He knows full well the significance of his death. He's aware he is fulfilling all things. He's in full control of the situation. Before he asked for the wine when he said he was thirsty, he knew it was done. He knew what was happening. Fulfilled, completed. Spiritually, what we celebrate 2,000 years later, the wages of sin is death, but the free gift of God is eternal life in Jesus Christ our Lord. The covenant is finally what? Fulfilled. The covenant we've been preaching about, studying, looking at, speculating on for nearly 6,000 years is finally what? Completed. It's done. Dr. John Pauline in his Bible Amplifier series on John says this. He says, God was never more faithful to his covenant with us than when he gave the wages of sin to Jesus. He is our Son of Man. For John asked Paul, Jesus was obedient to death for only one reason, and that was to fulfill the covenant. The only way for us to be saved without the cross was for the law and for the wages of sin to be completely changed. And we knew God wasn't going to do that. Instead, it was at the cross that God ratified his faithfulness to the covenant. Every messianic prophecy finished. The truth is down to the minutest detail. The type of garment that was divided. What was wagered for. How the body of Jesus was handled. Psalm 22 said his clothes would be divided. Isaiah 53 says his grave was with the wicked and his tomb was with the rich. The Passover scriptures would say that not a bone was to be broken in the Passover lamb. But was it really completed? Yes, it was finished. Yes, it was done. How do they know? When they came to Jesus and saw that he was already what? Already dead. See, they didn't believe that he was dead. They couldn't believe he was dead. It's only been 3 hours. And since he was already dead, they didn't what? They didn't break his legs. Not a single bone of his would be broken. Instead, one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and at once blood and water came out. Jesus' death is confirmed by unbiased people. These are people that have absolutely no bias. They don't have a stake in the game, not these Roman soldiers. They're just following orders, and they have to make sure. When we tell Pilate he's already dead, he's going to think something went wrong, so that soldier makes sure of it. So John is pointing out, in case you missed it, y'all, he's dead. John would be concerned with rumors by the time he writes his gospel that are quite popular by now. That is, that Jesus really didn't die. The rumor is that wine was a powerful sedative and it made it look like he was dead. That's why he refused it at first in the other gospels. But he appeared dead, and when the disciples got him down, they revived him and then went and proclaimed that he was resurrected. John needs us to know, no, he was dead, and he was confirmed dead by Rome. And John is also saying, I was there. I know he was. Explain the empty tomb any way you want. John assures us that when he was taken down from the cross, he was dead, and it was according to Scripture and prophecy like everything else. Death brings to close the entire cycle God has sought to bring before the beginning of time, before the covenant. Well, the covenant with Adam and Eve. On the day that you eat of it, you shall surely cross is the most popular, the most recognizable sign of this weekend. You with me? When we think of this weekend, when we think of everything this weekend, what's the thing that comes to mind? Bulletin covers, pictures, paintings. It's the cross. Real cool motion backgrounds. It's the cross. It's the most popular sign. It's the most recognizable sign. But there is one other sign. One other sign of this weekend. It's a peculiar one, though. Do you know what the sign is? It's the Sabbath. See, the Sabbath ends up becoming a character. The Sabbath ends up becoming the sign. At the Sabbath was, I almost think that he did it for us. He did it for the peculiar people whose worship is going to fall in between and who are not real thrilled with the sign and the words and the way that it's referred to and what the popular church does. But since it was the day of preparation, the Jews did not want the bodies left on the cross during the Sabbath, especially because that Sabbath was a great day of solemnity. So they asked Pilate to have the legs of the crucified men broken and removed. Preparation, the Sabbath. That's what's about to happen. After all the fulfillment, it's the Sabbath that's the next sign. The cross, they take him down from it. It's done. It is what? It's finished. The next sign, also, to hearken back to when he was dead. If he's asleep, he's asleep. The next sign has to be the Sabbath. It is finished, right? It is finished. And it's the Sabbath. The two signs of the finished covenant, the two signs of the it is finished, is the cross, the most well known, and the Sabbath, the peculiar one. See, in Genesis, the Sabbath comes after the very good pronouncement of the creation of humanity. Everything up until that point was pronounced as good. After humanity was created, he said it was what? It was very good. And what comes next? The Sabbath. The one day of creation when the Creator rests with the true fruit of his presence, with them, humanity, us, face to face, walking and talking. When he gave himself up in order for us to be recreated, what happened next? The Sabbath, his rest. Life is found there and nowhere else. Life is found with him. This walking and talking full presence is only found in him and nowhere and no one else. After the fall, we draw away. Death's process begins. It began to come for them the second they fell. God comes to walk with them again, but they're afraid. God calls out to them, "Where are you? What? Who told you you were naked? Who told you that you had to hide from me?" I love the conversation. God says, "Guys, let me make you a deal. By the way, you know what a covenant is? It's a deal. It's a deal between two parties. God says, let me make you a deal. This new way you've chosen is going to be saturated with death and pain. Your new nature of selfishness is going to see to that. You will feel it underlying that death is coming. Always. How about I give you this time as a whole to process that? So your free will have the time to decide who you are, to find out who you are to me. And in that whole time, I will reveal myself to you who I really am. And when that time is up, when the fullness of time comes, instead of your death ruling the day and having the final word, how about I die and I'll fulfill it? I'll let my own death instead of yours." And of course, we would chime in, wouldn't we? Wait, what? You make a covenant of life with us, we smash it, we throw it in your face, and you keep it. You pay the whole price. You fulfill both sides of the agreement. You take on our curse. You redeem us. That's what? That's crazy. And God cuts us off. Yeah, I know. I know it's crazy. You'll feel that way, by the way. When after it happens, you won't even know how to write about it. You won't even know how to refer to it. Remember I shared with you that 1 Corinthians? It's in the later chapter. I mean, the previous chapter from what Emma wrote, from what Gladys May said today. But we proclaim Christ crucified, a stumbling block to believers and foolishness to everybody else. Right? The cross. You're crazy. You're a fool. And everybody who believes in you is what? Are fools. Why would you do all that, Father? So I can walk and talk with you. I love you. I always have. And always will. I showed up to walk and talk with you the day before you fell and the day after. I show up walking and talking now, and in a few thousand years, I will continue to walk and talk with you. Because John will point out very clearly, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, and the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we've seen His glory. Glory as a Father's only Son, full of grace, full of truth. The creation, the fall, the recreation, all finished where? At the cross. And celebrated in rest when? On the Sabbath. But it is foolishness, isn't it? We proclaim Christ crucified. Crucified, stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. Paul says, for I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Gentiles don't believe it because it's foolishness. The world they live in, you don't win by dying. Not in this kingdom. You win by killing and making sure everybody pays their own price and debt. The cross is a stumbling block to believers because they know that God says He paid it all, but they still want to make sure that they have something no one else has. My own works, according to the law. Give God a reason to save us. Be good people, because nobody loves bad people. When God came to Adam and Eve to walk and talk with them after they had fallen, they simply could not believe that He still loved them. They insisted, let us become good first. Let us come up with a plan. Let us cover up who we are in order for you to continue to like us. We'll get to the point where we even make the cross an idol. Carry it around. Wear it. Put it on signs. Put it on flags. We'll get to where we make the cross a weapon. As if we have this magical authority from heaven that no one else will have. And if you're feeling as smug as I am right now, isn't that the same we've done with the other less publicized sign, the Sabbath? Sabbath was the one relationship from God's love that wasn't supposed to be able to be manipulated into anything. Why? Because it was made out of time. It wasn't made out of wood or made out of stone. He built us a cathedral in time. But haven't we taken it at times and trivialized it? Making it a list of righteous and unrighteous deeds and arguments of what is to be and what isn't and how we use it as a standard to keep people in or to keep people out. We've proclaimed that the seal of God is the seventh-day Sabbath and our special obedience is what makes us special, when actually the Sabbath should be the proclamation and the living of the one love that God has for everyone. That's the three angels' message. our own precious understanding of everything up until this point. Keep the commandments of God. Have the testimony of Jesus. Love God. Love your neighbor as yourself. But when we begin to live out the Sabbath for others, we take them back to the stone. We take them back to the letter, and we argue. And rest on the Sabbath, because even though we can make it our idol, even though that we are sinners and we can make the cross and the Sabbath into idols, that we can make them into tools to be better than somebody else, we are in need of salvation. And today we can rejoice because we proclaim Christ crucified. Because they may have been signs, but it wasn't the cross. It wasn't the Sabbath. It was Him. It's always been Him. Our search, our guilt, our shame, our righteousness, all in Him. It is what?